Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now. I'm your host, Keith Mavidigansini. Today I'm talking to Liz Weber, a member of the accessibility team of the Broadway musical, How to Dance in Ohio. Liz, welcome to the show. So we haven't officially met yet in person, not over Zoom. So how did you first become aware and involved with the Broadway musical How to Dance in Ohio?
In December of 2022, Sammy Cannell, the director, she posted on her Instagram story looking for a stage manager who identifies as having autism. And I do. And then there were interview processes, and I was originally going to be part of their earlier workshop, and then I had other conflicts, so that didn't work out. But I was really, really excited that I was invited back to the Broadway process.
When you first saw that announcement and read the synopsis of the musical, what was going through your head and through your heart as a autistic person?
Yeah, when I saw that the Broadway show was being announced, I was not involved yet at that moment, and I was very excited. I was like, this is exactly what disability needs for representation on the stage. This is what the theater industry needs for inclusivity. Like, I was very, very, very excited. And then I remembered that I had interviewed for this show a few months earlier in a different iteration. So then I reached back out and I was like, hey, maybe there's room for me. And there was, and it was pretty cool.
I saw this show 6 times, including the Broadway reunion concert, which was a marvelous night, a very interesting concept for a musical that just closed. Normally, I don't go to see musicals that much, but the soundtrack swept me away, and wanting to see these characters again and again. I've already mapped out that you guys have just completed the movie. Jacob and Rebecca have completed part 2 and are in pre-production of part 3. That's all a fantasy in my head. I've said that to every episode I've talked about this musical. So clearly it had struck a chord with me, and I'm not autistic. I have cerebral palsy. I went in to viewing this show with very low expectations, because I'm like, this could go either way, and I'm so far removed from my teenage years. Am I going to be able to relate to these characters? Boy, did I ever. Obviously, you have autism, and so your relation to it is vastly different than mine. But Are there similarities, or did you hear about people say, I didn't expect to love this show as much as I did, but man, it really swept me off my feet. And if you did, how would you like receiving that feedback, being so intimately involved with the show?
Yeah, no, I think the something that was sort of interesting about the reception of the show is that there was never a prior example of like.
True.
So I think that we were all kind of learning and growing as a collective force, because this type of nuance in mainstream Broadway theater has never happened before. And so then obviously there were some fans who were really, really intensely wanting to get all the information. And then there were some fans who were kind of just blown away that there was representation at all. And like there was a whole wide scope of that. And we were kind of adapting to how different people would warmly react to this show in different ways as it happened.
Yeah, I've spoken with a lot of your colleagues and even some of the actors, and I interviewed Jacob last season, and I'm always remarking or wondering, what do you think? As I've asked your colleague, what do you think, or why do you think this project in particular inspired Broadway to get some cojones and actually, I mean, shocker, be inclusive? I mean, you had examples few and far between, like The Prom, which premiered about a year or two earlier, but be in terms of inclusivity and diversity of representation, and you had some other examples, but really, those are the few and far between ones. What do you think? Was it about this documentary that really grabbed Broadway?
I think that, as you said, the examples were pretty widespread, and there's not a ton of representation in many facets prior to this point, and there's still so much work to do. But I think there are two things that probably made this show able to be told really accessibly, is that it wasn't like a common household name, really. Some people did know the documentary, but it certainly wasn't like lots and lots of people knew the premise of this story prior to its coming to Broadway. And then it's also, I think, that a lot of the people who were involved with the show, they had such heart and care and wanted the show to exist. So I think that that combination of a lot of people not like, I guess what I'm saying is like Curious Incident in the Dog of the Nighttime. That's
Yeah.
kind of the last show where there was an autistic character on stage.
Yep.
But we know that there were obviously problems with that, and that there wasn't an autistic cast member playing that role.
Yeah.
And it's, but that story had like a widespread
Appeal.
catch, you know, like
Yeah.
everyone sort of knew that story outside of it.
Yeah.
So this was nuanced in that people many people didn't know the story, and then they fell in love with the story both through Broadway and through the documentary.
Yeah, I'm really glad I did not see the documentary before I saw the musical. In fact, I saw the documentary after the musical closed. So this was after seeing it three times, or however many I did. Much be more than that. I saw it six times. So after my fifth time of seeing it, I finally watched the documentary, and I was so pleasantly shocked how faithful the book writer and the composer stayed remarkably true to the documentary. I can only think of one major plot point in the musical that was nowhere. Nowhere in the documentary. And I got all of the jokes, all of the references taken from the documentary since I had seen the musical so much. And I can't really remember a documentary before transferring to Broadway.
I think there have definitely been a few documentaries that have made their life cycle, but I think that's also what's exciting about this show. It's all based on real people, and obviously there were character liberties taken, and there was artistic creativity and all that stuff, but it really was a homage to the people they were actually playing.
Could you tell us about what it was like being behind the scenes and also on the accessibility team? Because that's shockingly a revolutionary concept for
Yeah,
Broadway
totally.
in
So,
and of
there
itself.
were five of us on the accessibility team. And we all kind of had different core roles on the show, in different departments beyond just accessibility. So I was on the stage management team, and my role, as accessibility deemed me fit, was sort of backstage maintenance. It was sort of making sure that all of the actors and performers, both neurotypical and neurodivergent, were comfortable in their skin. And if they had any accessibility needs, I would do my best to rectify them. This is for literal things. Like, I was doing a lot of the maintenance of making sure that the sensory spaces were to date, and that we had sensory toys available that were unwrapped and easily accessible and easily sorted. And it was mi making sure that we got gels of like fluorescent lights covered so that they weren't so bright and obnoxious. It was making sure that the sounds backstage and on stage weren't too loud. It was sort of making sure that there was non-scented soap that would in the bathrooms, because it was just a lot of things. It was acquiring knowledge from our company members and then sort of redistributing it, using some of my own knowledge of autism and being like, okay, these are things that will help make the company gradually feel safer and more comfortable. And yeah. So it was a there were a whole bunch of different things that we did. I like I said, I was focused more backstage on the actual company of the show. But then there were other members of the accessibility team who did a lot of communication with brand partnerships and making sure front of house was accessible for audience members. And so there was a whole lot that we all did, and we all kind of took on different facets of this role and this team accessibility thing.
Even though you were primarily backstage, do you remember the opening night of the Broadway show and what it was like for the actual, or at least some of the actual documentary participants, to be there observing what really happened to them, creative liberties aside, 10 years
It was
ago?
really, really, really cool. A lot of the actors became actual friends, real life counterparts. I know that a lot of them became like, and even the ones that didn't necessarily become lifelong friends, they still like got to watch and observe who these people they were portraying every night on stage were. And I think it's made for some really, really interesting acting studies, even. Like, it's
Yeah.
they're not emulating the person. Like,
No,
they're not.
no.
And there's a character that's been fabricated that's
Yeah.
totally not the real person, but it's still there was a nice level of collegiacy, like where everyone just sort of wanted to make everyone look good and be the best version of each other that they could.
Yeah, I mean, the actors have mentioned that profusely, that it wasn't mimicking
No.
anyone. It was enacted the characterization of the characters in the musical were done with the utmost care of their real life counterpart and creative liberties were taken. But that's very, very important to drive home, that what you just said about it being both a composite but also faithful to the real life person to a extent where it wasn't a exact copy. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, no, it was
Yeah.
definitely more like paying tribute or homage or
Yeah.
making sure someone felt safe and respected. But also, like, there were plenty of character changes that were made for the show on Broadway so that they are still separate entities altogether. Like, yeah, there were plenty of adjustments that made it much more of its own individual character for the show.
I know that the real life Dr. Amigo came to the show a ton. I've met him several times. Did anyone else come back to the show repeatedly?
I mean, yeah, there were tons of fans who saw the show tons of times.
Yeah.
Paula Abdul, one of the producers, co-producers, she came and saw the show quite a few times.
Really? Paula Abdul, the
Yeah.
singer, American Idol fame. Wow.
She was
Okay.
one of the co-producers on the show, and she loved it. Yeah, there were a whole bunch of people who really felt hard fast with the show, from Broadway celebrities to not Broadway celebrities to like just regular people. Lots and lots of people were making return trips.
Yeah, I remember following Jacob, his Instagram, and he would post regularly fans' reaction. I've just gone to see this show upwards of 20 times, and that blew my mind sky high, 'cause I just never experienced or read that reaction to any musical before. What did that do and other similar responses do to boost morale, or what were some of the biggest morale boosters throughout the show?
I think the first preview had an audience that no one was expecting, and no one could have anticipated prior to doing that first preview performance.
How so?
That first preview performance was highly anticipated, and it had a large swath of disabled patrons in it,
Yeah.
as you'd expect. But we had not, obviously, like when you're in rehearsal and in tech, you're building the show, but you're sort of missing that final
Yeah.
component.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody could have anticipated that when the seven came out on stage for that first preview performance, they got like a standing ovation for 3 minutes or something. And it was just crowd screaming and like insane. And this happened at other performances too, for
Yeah,
sure.
yeah.
But we couldn't have, I don't think there was a way to know what that would have been prior to
Yeah.
seeing that audience, because it was awesome and we loved it. And like the cast was exhilarated by it, and the cast got like the most energy ever. Everyone wants a standing ovation before they even say anything, like
Oh, yes.
totally.
Yeah.
But no one, I don't think anyone could have anticipated that that was the reaction that would have come, because how do you know that 1,000 people are going to stand up before you even do anything? Like that's,
Yeah.
but
Yeah.
we needed representation so badly on a Broadway stage that we were seeing reactions that Broadway's never seen before in any sort of capacity. Like we were seeing new things, and that's great too.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, and really good that this show came out when it did. Had they dared tried to do this show even 5 years ago, I will bet you anything that they would have used unauthentic representation. They would have gotten big names in there, which, I mean, big names, nothing wrong with that, but what really hooked me on this show is seeing seven artistic actors play seven artistic roles.
Correct.
That's it. That was the main hook as a disability advocate. And I really don't think we would have gotten that at any other previous time. As a kid, I'll happily bet money on that hypothetical, because, and so the first preview was special. I would assume the first Broadway performance with some of the real life counterparts. What were some others that really carried the morale through the production?
I mean, every single performance was great and nuanced, and we would see human reactions to everything, and we would see people with such energy, feeling such excitement and emotions and all that. Yeah, no, I think that it's hard to just think about individual performances because of what it did as a collective movement, as a force almost,
Okay,
because
so talk more about that. What do you think and what do you feel that the musical did as a collective force in terms of disability advocacy?
I really think that the musical brought, for the first time to a Broadway space, I think it brought the idea of mainstream inclusivity. I think it brought the idea that this can happen, so future shows can't now just be like, okay, we'll hire inauthentic casting for a disabled character that is not played by a disabled role. Like, I think what it has done is because, really, again, to be the first of something, and obviously, like, there's so far to go in making sure Broadway theaters are accessible.
That's
Like,
it.
long, long ways to go. And most Broadway theaters don't have great wheelchair options. And, like, there's a lot to build from. But what I do think the show did is it allowed for that to be the first, like, of its kind, for there to be more accessibility just woven into normal shows that don't have a disability focus. Like, I think that prior to this show, there was a lot of maybe misconstrued beliefs about how disabled people can be at a Broadway show, or if they could be there at all. And I think that, at least with How to Dance in Ohio, we have that as an example that these people want to be here. They want to see the show. They just maybe didn't have the right accommodations that would let them be there before. Or, and obviously, like, there have been long, long-standing attempts with many other accessibility organizations to make theater better. But I think this massive, massive first widespread scale of this facet, right? This first massive undertaking is gonna give many people more hope in that capacity. Like, TDF does accessibility performances for pretty much all the Broadway shows, and they're wonderful and they're great. But I think that How to Dance in Ohio, bringing this viewpoint to every single performance, was new and special because it's also like, oh, maybe I can go to a show and I don't have to worry about the consequences of what I have to do tomorrow. Or, like, yeah, in the future. It's like, oh, I feel safe here and I'm always feeling safe here. And there's not a conditional factor of if I feel safe by which performance it is.
So TDF is really the only reason I got to meet Jacob, and through him, I got to meet most of, if not a good portion of the cast and crew. So TDF, I was not a part of the accessibility program at the time, and I had just bought a ticket to them. And when you're not a part of the accessibility program, they just send the requests over the morning of. The venue randomizes or randomly picks the seats. And it put me in the row in front of a couple that knew Jacob, and they were conversing, and I managed to overhear who Jacob was, and I was debating in my head, do I talk to him? Do I not? Do I talk to him? Do I not? After he finished the conversation with his friends, and I made a split second decision, and I had my business cards out. Well, I grabbed his arm and said, excuse me, are you the composer of this show? And I complimented him and handed him all my business cards and said, I would love to interview anyone involved with this production, but normally I would not do that. I am very, very reserved when I go to Broadway shows, and particularly when I know people are there. People just want to have a good time. But in terms, so I took a risk, reaching out to Jacob, and that's how I became involved with this from a fan's perspective. Where, if there was a part two to this musical, and it's very hard to do that with a documentary, what would you hope that a part two would explore? What themes would you hope would be in there?
I think if there was a sequel to this show, I would probably enjoy a deeper dive onto some of the characters' relationships in a non-heterosexual capacity, because there were two queer characters who didn't necessarily have a lot of that visibly explained, but not that it needs it either, because I think we are beyond a point where we need to explain what a gay person is. I think we all know.
Yeah,
So
or we should.
there's a little bit of both of that. We should at least, but like
Yeah.
I think so there I see that argument, but I also think that it could be something totally different. Maybe it's how people These people are existing not in a social skills group, how they are
Yeah.
developing after their dance, and how,
Yeah.
I would also like to see more of the parents, and I'd like to see, there's so much that I would have loved to see, but there's only a 2-hour musical, and
Yeah.
obviously, like, you have only so much to do, and you can't put, the entire DSM about autism in a musical. You can
No.
try, but it just You sometimes have to add in other things too.
I mean, there was one quick mention that I wanted to know so much more about is the prior friendship of Mel and Ashley when they would get together and play video games. And you got a bit of a sly answer with reincarnation in Act Two, but that would be one area where because that was the only real verbalization or example of someone who worked at the center interacting with a client outside of the center. And I found that very appealing to. I wanted to know so much more about that relationship and the ebbs and flows of it.
Yeah, I mean, there was a song that was cut about halfway through previews, called Life Interrupts. And that song got us a little bit more of Ashley's story. But I do agree. I would have liked to see more of that dynamic because it I also really loved the Ashley character because she was a non-autistic character that had problems. And it was nice to see that. I mean, everyone has problems, we all know this, but like it was nice to see that she had a whole list of things that she wanted to fix, and it had nothing to do with her being autistic.
No, but there's an interesting dynamic there, or there could be, doesn't need to be, but go with me for a second. There have been a lot more late diagnosed autistics. And so if I were to suggest another idea for the sequel, just hypothesizing here, you'd said that Ashley isn't autistic and she wasn't in the first one. What would it be like? And of course, we can't know that, but what would it be like playing with the idea of having her discover later in her journey that she is autistic? I mean, we don't need that, but it would be an interesting dynamic.
I think,
You don't have to agree, by the way.
yeah, sure. No, I think that the thing that part of that, what made that show so special is that there were the combination of actors and people backstage all were coming at autism from different levels of experience. So yeah, there were some actors who were diagnosed when they were like 2 or 3 years old. And then there were some other actors who were diagnosed when they were in high school, when they were like 16. And it I think because we had that whole wide variety of people on their personal journeys, that we didn't actually need to talk about those things because maybe in a character sense, it could have been interesting. But as far as like the actual representation, we had that full scope.
Oh, yes,
So
yes, you did. And I've heard from other cohorts in the years ago that it would have been nice and beneficial to get a non-verbal autistic character in the show or in a possible sequel. And but you're right, particularly for a first go, being the first real show, you guys did cover so much. You didn't get to cover everything, and you couldn't have. But for what you did cover, you covered a lot of
totally.
ground. And so, if there are any advocates listening to this, wanting to get involved with theater at any level, getting involved with self-advocacy, and listening to this interview and watching it, as someone who is in musical theater or theater in general, what would be some advice you would give aspiring advocates wanting to make their way into working in the creative arts in terms of advocacy?
I think I don't have a actual answer for this because I don't have any like tips for breaking into the Broadway, but it throughout my career I have noticed that like if the people who are backing the project, the people who are like hiring and producing and et cetera, if those the people who are backing the project seem to have progressive beliefs and that they want to make change happen, the show will have that as an underscoring. Like, yeah, I think that when there are sometimes there are shows where the writing is very much, this is progressive, this is inclusion, and sometimes the acting and directing too. But it has to really be built into the skin of the project in every capacity because obviously, like the writers have hiring people, the writers are just writing down their brilliant words. And so I think that in these specific scenarios, if the people who are passionate about making the show happen seem to be passionate about things beyond just the show, I find that that is an environment that I usually feel safest in.
How do you think that more Broadway shows and even off-Broadway shows and off-off-Broadway shows can implement the accessibility team model to make their shows and productions more inclusive?
I do think accessibility should be in a part of much more theater in general and should be like there should be people dedicated to this process in many more capacities than just shows about disability. But I think really where the place to start is asking about company members' needs. Because if you start with care for the company, then you can work outwards and go for to the audience, because obviously you have to care about both. And I think that if your company feels safe and comfortable, then that's at least then the audience feels safer on that as a baseline. So even obviously, like, there are millions of things that can be done to make individual spaces more accessible and better for different types of audiences, but I do think that, like, just making sure that the company is heard as a starting point and then working outwards, that is definitely a good way for shows to go from in forward, because not every person will have the same accessibility needs either. So, like, it is important that each situation is handled with tact and grace, and that individuals feel like they can have a voice and they can feel like they can be listened to.
So there are a lot of erroneous perceptions or assumptions about autistic people, and I'm sure you don't need me to name them, but for the listener and viewer, you're not funny, you're savant, you're not friendly, etc., etc. Why do you think that's such wrong perceptions of autistic people and of autism in general still persists to this day? And if they outrage me as someone who is not autistic, I cannot fathom how much they must aggravate you in your daily life because they persist so much. And so, why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it probably has to do with gender perceptions of
Interesting.
autism. Obviously, I am not a cisgender dude who, and not there, while the traits are all pretty much the same and can be interchangeable, and like no one has the same diagnosis as someone else, and I do think that a lot of the world is, at this current moment, is accustomed to seeing autism in boys, because that is
Yeah.
how it has been predominantly diagnosed up until now.
You're right.
And that makes for a huge difference in existing anyway, because, like, when if you're socialized as a woman, as you if you grow up as a woman and you're autistic, the autism might come later because you have to deal with all of the social nuances of blending into society as a woman. For example, like, oftentimes, if a woman is blunt or harsh with her words or tone, that's considered rude. And it might really just be autism, but there's some social conditioning of that gender
Yeah.
disparity that I think makes it so a lot of women are later diagnosed in life because their traits were, oh, they were being quiet and shy, and
Yeah.
that is exactly what was expected of women in a submissive role in history. So I think now, as neurodiversity is becoming more well per better perceived, not I wouldn't say well perceived, but I'd say
Yeah.
as people are becoming more aware that it's more of a set of traits that anyone can have, that I think we are in a we're going to be progressing into a world where there's a lot more learning and nuance and understanding. And I think that a lot of the stereotypes will begin to fade down as we sort of understand this disorder as a more holistic thing. and that it's not exclusive to 4-year-old boys who can't focus. Like that, and I know that's ADHD, but like that's the sort of type that people have in their head, and I think there's a lot to expand and develop from it.
You mind if I ask when you were diagnosed and what your earliest memories of receiving that diagnosis and trying to understand it?
I'm a little bit of an interesting scenario because I was brought in for testing when I was really little, when I was like 2 or 3. But then the doctors said, if she starts skipping, she'll be very smart. If. Shouldn't be an if, but anyway.
Wait, what did they say it to?
If she starts speaking, she will be very smart. So I
Oh boy.
eventually did start speaking, and then that pushed my diagnosis to the side until I was like 18 and on my own insurance. But I've definitely remembered sort of the whole process of learning things and then being like, oh, that matches me. Oh, maybe I'm not just like this really weird kid. Maybe there's a reason for me being a little bit weird. And I think the diagnosis process totally helped me become more confident in myself and understanding of why I may do certain things a certain way.
So, when did you start speaking?
I was probably about 3, but like not great sentences.
There's a personal reason why I asked that. My voice didn't come in till age 7, and it took countless hours and years for me to get the voice. I do. I have cerebral palsy and I'm very bullish over my voice and having it be respected for the uniqueness and the great gift that it is. Let's question, although I'm sure we could talk for several hours about all the amazing aspects of this production, and we could fantasize and hypothesize everything that needs to happen in order to make Broadway inclusive and diverse, like it always should be. We've talked about a lot of things in this episode, and I'd like to think that both people with disabilities and people who have yet to discover and embrace their disabilities both watch and listen to this program. I'm not naive to think that both groups and groups within those groups take away the same things. So, as my guests, what do you hope that advocates with disabilities take away from this episode? And what do you hope that people who have yet to discover or embrace their own disabilities take away from this episode?
I think that I hope that people who have disabilities, whatever the disability may be, sort of feel like they are not stuck to a path of limiting themselves. Like 2 years ago, if you told me I was going to be making my Broadway debut on a show about my disability, And then I would later win a Drama Desk Award for the accessibility work I did. I wouldn't have believed you at all. And like, obviously, there's a lot of work that we all have to do together, and there's only dreams that we can precipitate somehow. But I think keeping ourselves stuck in boxes, thinking, well, I can't do this because I'm disabled, is limiting. There are some things we can't do, and that is super true and valid and important. But to open our mind and see that maybe there's a future where this can happen or where that can happen, or if we work for it, maybe we will be feeling a little bit less isolated and a little bit less like we are on our own. I think that would be a good future for everyone. I think people will feel safer if they just know that there is an option. Not immediately, maybe not tomorrow, but just that we can do this and together we can grow and we can work together to make more of this happen and more people feeling seen and safe in ways that has never happened before.
What do you hope that people who have yet to discover or embrace their own disabilities take away from this episode? And I had to add one more question at the end in to wrap up a question I just asked.
I think that people who maybe are still learning to accept themselves and haven't figured out their disability journey all the way, I think that there's a lot of learning about others to be done to make oneself feel comfortable. I know that before I was diagnosed, I probably had some misconstrued thoughts about autism and neurodiversity as a whole, and learning that I fit within the boxes that made me feel so different, that there was a community of people like me, like who knew things adjacent to my life, and that was very helpful in feeling comfortable in myself, because there was a lot of self-doubt. There was a lot of, why am I so different? And understanding that not all disabilities are qu created equal, and that not everyone will be top of their game or whatever. It's comforting to know that you're not like an overeating failure or anything like that.
Because I asked you, why do you think the pervasive wrong assumptions towards autistic people and autism remain shockingly front and center to ask the other side of that question, what do you, as a autistic person, as a disability advocate, wish that people would know and understand about autistic people and autism in general? Because again, like every show started with the very true phrase, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. What do you hope that people in the next few years begin to learn and understand about autism and autistic people? Sorry, that's a big question, but it felt right.
I think that in the future, I hope that a lot of people think that autism is the end of someone's life, which, especially as we've been like reclaiming autism and straying away from words that are indicative of labels, functioning labels that we don't really like anymore. I think as we sort of move away from that language that was segregatory, I'm hoping that people's opinion of the word autism itself digresses, because I think a lot of there, even within the autistic community, there's a lot of people trying to hold on to old labels, which were originally disbanded because they were tethered to Nazi eugenics, which we don't want to carry into this society anymore. But I think that a lot of people aren't able to comprehend that we're not using levels as categories. We are trying to make everyone feel like they are one and they are welcome. And I think that when once that sort of transgresses into being how the language is used, and when there's not this fear that's been mongered from this word that is harmless, I think there will be a lot more progressiveness happening in the space. And I think that once people realize that autistic people proudly identify as autistic and proudly use this word and hone in on it, I think there will be a lot more clarity in the future, and I think people will feel a lot safer.
Lidge, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope you know you're always welcome on this show. If someone wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to do that?
Probably via Instagram.
What's your handle, if I may ask?
At Liz Weber Tech.
Well, Liz Weber, again, I want to thank you profusely for coming on and for closing out at least part one of this mini season on this terrific and much needed Broadway musical about inclusiveness and representation, How to Dance in Ohio. Thank you to all of my guests for sharing their wisdom and insight across the production and its impact. And I hope to talk to you all again very soon. You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guests, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on our social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts, or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, and share the podcast. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2024.